Perfect piece, you might say, at the end of Vaughan Williams' Fifth Symphony, a transcendental symphonic journey through The Pilgrim's Progress, the opera which he was in the middle of writing at the time, performed here in the Royal Albert Hall as the second BW Symphony in tonight's BBC Prom by the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra under its associate guest conductor and great BW advocate Andrew Manzi. First thing he did was to bring the principal horn, David Flack, to his feet. Well, if the fifth is a return to Vaughan Williams' pastoral mood, the evocative music's made stronger by the way it's shaped in such a subtly thought-out symphonic argument. The result, you have to think, of the tautly structured fourth. And there was a rather wicked thought in Andrew Manzi's mind at one point that he was going to segue, go straight from the fourth into the fifth without any break. He did kind of think the orchestra might string him up somewhere, so he didn't do it. But they do make extraordinary, contrasting companion pieces. Back on the platform, Andrew Manzi. The first performance of the symphony was conducted by Vaughan Williams himself during the 1943 prom season in this building, and I suspect he was standing on the same podium with the half-moon brass rail on which Andrew Manzi is now standing and taking the applause of the house. Luminous music, isn't it, like stained glass windows. Except that quixotic fleeting scherzo with those echoes of Ravel's in those elusive dabs of colour. A reminder that Vaughan Williams studied with Ravel, of course. Back once again. Tonight's conductor, Andrew Manzi, bringing the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra to its feet. And the opera, which was so influential on that music, The Pilgrim's Progress, gets a new production this November at English National Opera. Well, that symphony may mark the end, in a way, of the first stage of Vaughan Williams' symphonic journey. But it has a newfound sense of purpose, which continues in the sixth, which, albeit in music surrounded by a sense of spiritual desolation, we'll be hearing after the interval here in the Royal Albert Hall. And on Radio 3, we turn from music to words, but stay with Vaughan Williams as we head down the steps to the Royal College of Music to join Rana Mitter.
Tonight, I'm talking to the composer Anthony Payne, who has a deep affinity with the English classical tradition. Witness his temporary inhabitation of the shade of Edward Elgar in completing his Third Symphony. And so Anthony Payne is a perfect person to explore the character and work of another of its towering figures, Ralph Vaughan Williams. Vaughan Williams's Fourth, Fifth and Sixth Symphonies are, of course, featuring in tonight's prom, but there's a lot more to him than just an elderly English gent who loved the countryside. He comes across as a forthright personality in his letters and also in the accounts of those who knew him well, such as his second wife, Ursula Wood. So, Tony, I was wondering, why doesn't Vaughan Williams seem to command as much attention today as, say, Elgar or Britten?
I think he suffered, like a lot of composers who were extremely highly thought of at the point that he died. He went through a period when he was ignored a bit, and there was a new generation of young critics with whom I did not align, who ran him down at the expense of, well, the new moderns and say, Benjamin Britten. And I've always felt that you don't have to run someone down in order to espouse the cause of another. You ought to espouse both causes. But I think he was just a victim of the passing of time. And now, to judge by the returns that one gets from performing rights from his works, he's being performed all over the place. And, I mean, we have three, four complete sets of the symphonies recorded. So I don't think he's being neglected, but he still is being misunderstood by some, actually.
Yes, I mean, perhaps to be a bit provocative, is it still perhaps a little bit less respectable, a bit more gauche to say you're a lover of Vaughan Williams than, say, a lover of Britten? Or is that not so much the case anymore?
No, I don't think it is. When I came down from university to London, loving all that English turn of the century music you were talking about, and also the moderns, I didn't dare speak about them. I would have been looked at as someone who crawled out from under a stone if I spoke about Elgar, Vaughan Williams, Delius. One spoke about Messiaen, Varèse, Boulez, Stockhausen, Ligeti. But I love those too.
Of course, the two are not incompatible with each other, and if one's crawling from under a stone, at least perhaps it's traditional Cotswold stone in that particular particular case. Vaughan Williams is associated with a particular sort of Englishness, and certainly he identified himself as an English composer. But perhaps
yes.
his idea of England was one that went in and out of fashion through the
yes,
course of
I
the century.
Yes, I think that's possibly true. I mean, for all his Englishness, he was stylistically a cosmopolitan, just as Elgar was. And I'm always being asked the question, as you can imagine, what is it that's so English about Elgar? And the answer is, I don't know. And I know what's English about Vaughan Williams because he does have that relationship to the folk song movement, and of course a strong relationship to English Tudor music. But Elgar didn't have that. He had a strong relationship to German and French music, so what's English about that? And Vaughan Williams found himself when he learned, I think, how to relate that Englishness to Ravel, Debussy, etc. So there's that double-sidedness.
Well, we can get a very strong sense of Vaughan Williams' sense of his own Englishness, actually, from a letter that he wrote when he was just in his 20s to his cousin, Ralph Wedgwood. And I'm delighted to give us the readings this evening. We have the actor Dominic Rowan with us. Dominic.
Tuesday. I haven't yet told you about Lymington. I always imagined that Lymington was a small and unpleasant watering place, but is in reality a delightful and very sleepy little town which happens to be by the Solent and to look across to the Isle of Wight. Here comes in another of my delusions. I always imagined that the Isle of Wight was a gimcracky kind of a place, but what we saw of it was a magnificent stretch of downs and white cliffs. Don't think me degenerate in my likes, but you know, I have always preferred soft scenery to stern, uncomfortable scenery. I can admire it, but I can't really enjoy it. I know that shows a craven spirit, but I can't help it. My heart goes through the same maneuvers as Wordsworth's when he saw a rainbow, when I see a long, low range of hills. I suppose this comes from being born in Surrey, S.W.
The thing that struck me about this passage was that there's a sort of confession there, really, from Vaughan Williams, that he prefers perhaps the homely to the sublime. And there's also a bit of a leg pull, because he says he's born in Surrey, but actually, of course, he was born in Gloucestershire, in Downampney.
Mm. Yes, but and also remember that was written when he was still quite young. But there was no doubt that, interestingly, that he liked cityscapes more they meant almost more to him than countryscapes. There was the famous time when he went to America and saw Niagara Falls and the skyscrapers of New York, and found them more intriguing and more tremendous, man-made things, than that he found Niagara Falls. I mean, Vaughan Williams is full of contradictions, actually. That's the thing.
Well, of course, two of the symphonies that we're not hearing tonight, but of course remain amongst the best known, one is on London and one is on Antarctica. You can't really get further away than those.
Absolutely. I mean, his symphonies as a whole, they cover an amazing ground spiritually and emotionally. I remember thinking once when reading about the famous meeting between Mahler and Sibelius, when Sibelius spoke of the internal logic and purity of thought in the symphony, and Mahler said, oh, no, nothing like that. It must encompass the whole world, said Mahler. And my goodness, it does. Now, Vaughan Williams could actually write both types of symphony, so he could encompass the Mahlerian and the Sibelian. You can say that London Symphony is a Mahlerian kind of a work because it includes popular things. It also includes vulgarity, functional vulgarity, and irony, and symphonies number 3, say the partial, and number 5 are absolutely pure, and the 6th symphony, which we'll hear tonight, belongs to the sort of Mahlerian kind of symphony, although it's a mixture by then of these two things. But he has an enormous scope.
Do you think Vaughan Williams would have or did ever say that about himself? You know, that kind of wonderfully grandiloquent statement that it must contain the whole world. One sort of slightly imagines him shying away from something that sort of grandstanding.
Vaughan Williams would never have said anything like that. I wouldn't say self-doubting, but he was very modest about himself, the fact that he would go and take advice about how he should orchestrate a certain passage. And this has been held against him by the smarter critics, who thereby think that he's unprofessional. It's just he was a modest kind of a man.
He was also, of course, in some ways, a rather cussed sort of a man. And one of the letters of his that I was delighted to find, because it completely went against my assumptions about Vaughan Williams, was about his attitude towards politics. A letter that he wrote in 1952 to a fellow composer, Rutland Boughton. And Boughton, I think, was trying to get him to sign some sort of peace manifesto. And the reading says exactly what Vaughan Williams thought about this. Dominic.
When I was a boy at school, I and another boy stood out as radicals, as we were called then, against all the other boys. When I got to Cambridge in 93, I and a few friends read the Fabian Tracts and, in opposition to the majority of undergraduates, became socialists. This was probably before you were born. The truth is, I think that when I am with conservatives, I become socialistic. And when I am with socialists, I become a true blue Tory. Ever since I had the vote, I have voted either Radical or Labour, except once, after the war, when I was so disgusted by what I considered the mean trick of the Labour Party in forcing an election. I voted Labour in the last election, though in my heart of hearts, I wanted the Tories to get in. But the old spirit of opposition crept up, and with all the country shouting for the Tories, I determined to be on the other side. So I assure you, my spirit remains what you call generous. I believe in freedom, and that is why I will not be bullied by Nazis, fascists, or Russians.
I mean, Anthony, should we be surprised to think of him as someone who would have been a Labour or indeed a radical leftist in the mid-20th century?
I'm not sure whether we should, really. I think a lot of people imagine, for instance, that those composers of ours that were writing at the same time as the early volumes will have been conservatives, but they weren't. Most of our great composers were of the left. The only one who wasn't was Elgar, who actually resigned from his club when the first Labour Prime Minister was voted a member of the club. Elgar immediately resigned. And I really detest that viewpoint, actually, I have to say. But, I mean, Delius was a lefty. People might have thought he wasn't, but he was. Holst was, of course. Rutland Boughton, we just mentioned. Vaughan Williams, Holst. They were men of the left.
And if he was perhaps not what we might expect in terms of his politics, he was also nonconformist, you might say, in terms of his household arrangements. At one point, he was living with his wife, Adeline, but also at the same time with a younger woman, Ursula Wood, whom he married later on. And I think this was not public knowledge, but within Vaughan Williams' circle, amongst the musicians and others he knew, was this something that people knew about?
It is known by most people who know about Vaughan Williams, and as I've mixed with, I knew Ursula quite well and things like that. These things were mentioned. Ursula, I must say, on one occasion said, "It's so exciting to be the other woman." I'm not prepared to go any further than that.
Well, that sounds eminently reasonable. And judging by the letters I've seen, actually it did seem to be a rather happy arrangement for all three of them. Adeline did, of course, die, and Vaughan Williams married the widowed Ursula Wood in 1953, although, of course, he was about 40 years older than she was. And they also travelled abroad. They went to Greece, in fact, in 1955. And Ursula gives part of the account of their trip in her biography of Vaughan Williams. Dominic.
Our party was too large for one bus, but not enough for two. So six of us were given a Cadillac, driven by a very tall Greek called Hercules. He took charge of us, and because we could go much faster than the bus, we had all sorts of delightful and unscheduled stops. The first day of sightseeing was impressive. Daphne, by Byzantine mosaics, gazed down in mournful splendor, and where, As we stood in the courtyard, a dark-eyed Mercury, loitering with other locals to look at the tourists, came straight through the crowd to us and gave us each a branch of bay leaves. A touching welcome to the world of legend. Mycenae was all we had expected. The Lion Gate, the steep road, and the brooding ruins. It had the same air of menace that is so apparent at Corfe Castle, but being open and no longer dominated by any great building, it was more bearable. Our great moment was when we asked what was the distant hill with what looked like a fortress to the south, and Mr. Cook, the archaeologist who had in charge of us all, said briefly, Argos. The magic of the sea light, the herb-scented air, the stories we had lived with all of our lives had already made their impact. I am glad we are here, Rafe said.
Tony, the biography obviously very much a public document, and something that does come out very clearly from it is the very deep love and affection between the two of them. Do you feel that Ursula was an inspiration for the music?
I think Vaughan Williams was a self-contained visionary person. I mean, obviously outside things made impressions on him, and I'm not sure that those kind of impressions are in any way important to understanding the music. That's the main thing. People get it wrong, for instance, when they say that, and we know this, it's been argued over and over again, that the Fourth Symphony and all its violence is to do with the politicizing of the time. But in fact, he started to conceive of that work before the Nazis took over in 1933, and that the Fifth Symphony was a vision of peace in the middle of the war. But the conception was beginning to take shape sometime before the war, and he often himself said that we should not look to outside circumstances but just listen to the music. And I'm not sure whether his relationships with his wife or with Ursula, subsequently wife, did anything more than please and comfort him. I don't know whether they provided inspiration.
Well, actually, that very particular point about whether or not one should read a programme into his music is something that we do have a letter from Vaughan Williams to his friend Robert Longman about, and he is in fact talking exactly about that, about the Fourth Symphony. Dominic.
I spent yesterday in bed nursing a cold, so I decided to try to answer your long and splendid letter of a long time ago. One. I agree with you that all music must have beauty. The problem being, what is beauty? So when you say you do not think my F minor symphony beautiful, my answer must be that I do think it beautiful. Not that I did not mean it to be beautiful, because it reflects unbeautiful things, because we know that beauty can come from unbeautiful things, e.g. King Lear, Rembrandt's School of Anatomy, Wagner's Nibelungs, etc. As a matter of fact, one, I am not at all sure that I like it myself now. All I know is that it is what I wanted to do at the time. Two, I wrote it not as a definite picture of anything external, e.g. the state of Europe, but simply because it occurred to me like this. I can't explain why. I don't think that sitting down and thinking about great things ever produces a great work of art. At least I hope not, because I never do so. And when you state your belief in me, dear Bobby, I feel the completest of frauds. A thing just comes. Or it doesn't. Usually doesn't. I always live in hope, as all writers must, that one day I shall ring the bell. In younger days, when one thought one was going to do the real thing each time, and each time discovered one hadn't done it, one said hopefully, next time. But when one touches on 65, one begins to wonder.
So Vaughan Williams himself there warning us against trying to read too literalistically into his music. Mm. But at the same time, I mean, one thinks of other things that influence him. I mean, politics is one thing you mentioned there. But of course, he also visited New York. And people have said sometimes there's a sort of steely quality to the fourth, and one thinks of his description in one of his letters of the Plaza Hotel and the kind of steel skyscraper yes. canyons of New York.
Well, I mean, who can say? Listening to that letter, it's all very well saying him saying things just happen, but then your next question is why? Why did the Fourth Symphony happen at that time? And you really cannot answer that question. He might have got up one morning and all of a sudden thought, I'll do something like that. And he did it. And don't forget also that although it sounds, a lot of people felt it was the beginning of a new dissonant modernism in Vaughan Williams. I mean, it's Michael Kennedy who's quite rightly said, actually, it's not the beginning of a new phase in Vaughan Williams at all. It's the ending of an old phase, because we've heard music like that in Sancta Civitas, in the piano concerto, and this was a climactic expression of all that kind of thing. And immediately after, he moved on into other areas and didn't actually follow up on that particular language. It's almost unique in his output. And the fascinating thing is that it's absolutely pure Vaughan Williams from beginning to end. Nobody could have written it but him, and yet there aren't any other pointers back to it from later.
So what does that mean when, as tonight, we hear it as part of a programme of three consecutive symphonies? Because, of course, we're hearing the fourth and then the fifth and then the sixth.
Well, I mean, this is going to be an absolutely fascinating experience because they obviously all tie up together, and you'll see things, occasions in the Fourth Symphony, which you'll find in the later symphonies, just little links, which mean that they're by the same person. But they live in three different worlds, and this is an incredible thing. I remember at the time of Vaughan Williams' last works, and then around the time of his death, some commentators on his music were daring to mention the name of Beethoven in relationship to Vaughan Williams, and of course immediately afterwards other people thought that this was much too pretentious, fancy comparing Vaughan Williams with Beethoven. But after the years, and I've known these symphonies now for nearly 60 years, I do feel that there's only one other man I know of, I'm not saying that Vaughan Williams is as great as Beethoven, but who actually inhabits totally different worlds in his symphonies, like Beethoven 5, 6, 7, all live in totally different worlds, and they are all obviously by Beethoven. Listen to Vaughan Williams 3, 4, 5, and 6, and each one lives in an utterly different world, and that they're all by the same man. This is a phenomenal achievement, and I think this makes Vaughan Williams one of the truly great composers. And I didn't dare say this about 30 years ago, because people would have laughed at me, but I don't care whether they laugh at me now. He is a truly great composer on the strength, at least, of those four achievements, each one totally different, each one unified by his imagination. They all ring that bell.
I'm afraid that's all we have time for right now, so many thanks to Anthony Payne and to our reader, Dominic Rowan.
Rana Mitter presented that Proms Plus literary event. The producer was Zahid Worley, and Anthony Payne sitting just below me here in the Royal Albert Hall, entranced by the music he's hearing. Welcome back to the hall from me, Martin Handley, and to the second half of this BBC Prom, live, of course, here on Radio 3, home of the Proms. Tonight's orchestra is the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, and together with its associate guest conductor, Andrew Manzi, they're tackling a trio of Vaughan Williams symphonies, which demonstrate the huge range of his orchestral writing. We began tonight with the brutal fourth, followed by the serenity of the fifth. In the sixth symphony, which we hear now, Vaughan Williams sprang the biggest surprise of his symphonic career. I asked Andrew Manzi what he thinks VW set out to achieve.
He's brave. The thing I think of straight away is that he brings a saxophone into the orchestra. It's like challenging the whole establishment of what an orchestra is and what a symphony is. He brings an instrument from the jazz club. And I think it shows that although he's getting on a bit as a composer, he's really wanting to break new ground. But he doesn't want to show too much. He's quite a private man. But actually, when he's sitting there writing the music, he's showing an awful lot. I just think he doesn't want us to analyse it and put it in words. It's maybe painful enough for him to have exposed it in the symphony.
No, of course. I mean, he was, you know, always against people who were saying that the fourth was a, you know, the state of Europe in 1935, and that the sixth was post-war and the atomic apocalypse and so on. But then he did say about, you know, our little life rounded by a sleep, and you can hear something of that in the finale, can't you?
Yes, I definitely think you can. I think he's feeling, after the Second World War is finished, the loss greater than he's feeling the triumph that the war is finished. And that's what the symphony is perhaps is about, is an expression of loss and grief. I do hear post-atomic Holocaust in the finale. He's very cross with me for saying that, but I can't help but hear it. But it still applies in 2012. It still has this power.
Andrew Manzi, well, one new facet of the symphony is that the four movements are linked to form a continuous whole. As Vaughan Williams put it, each of the first three has its tail attached to the head of its neighbour. Symphony was first performed in 1948, was immediately popular, audiences seeming to accept the obvious change of direction in the music from the profound peace of the fifth. If the sixth, with its restless, adventurous energy, felt like a negation of that peace, then it also seemed to be an intense affirmation of humanity. Music riddled with tensions, often strident, dissonant, and even more extraordinary when you remember that Vaughan Williams was in his mid-70s at the time he completed it. Well, BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra's ready and waiting on the platform, and they're joined by their associate guest conductor, Andrew Manzi, to perform Vaughan Williams' sixth symphony.
Thank you.